You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Justin Nace in Toronto, Ontario. Justin is a front-of-house audio engineer, a tour manager, and more recently, a pasta maker. This interview was originally recorded on July 23rd, 2020. So to start with, can you introduce yourself for listeners?
My name is Justin Nace, and I am a front of house audio engineer and tour manager, recently pasta guy.
So that the juxtaposition or shift from one role to the other is kind of one of my favorite kind of quarantine COVID stories, because I guess when like the whole world kind of stopped from a live music angle, the optimist in me really wanted to see what came next. And I kind of want to hear, I guess maybe we'll go back to the beginning of the shutdown, which was probably kind of dramatic and crappy. And then maybe we'll move forward in time to your shifted focus of livelihood or whatever.
Sure.
So what was it like, I guess, back in mid-March? I don't know how much of a shock this came, and I don't know what position it put you in.
In mid-March, I was doing a bus tour with my good pal Andy Schaff. And we were, I was just audio on that one. And it was great. He just had a new record come out. We had just started the West Coast in parts of Middle America. Did the same with Canada. And we got back on, oh boy, I think we got back on March 8th. And then, yeah, and they were about to go to Europe. And it was like, are we doing Europe? Are we not doing Europe? And I was in my mind, I'm like, it's fine. It'll be fine. And then 2 days of being home and it's like, no, we're not going to Europe. It's crazy over there. And then it was crazy everywhere. I was under 14 days quarantine. And then I got feeling not well, still not sure what it was that I was not well with, but basically I was locked in my bedroom for 3.5 weeks until the beginning of April. It was super weird.
So in a weird way, the timing though, I mean, it could have been worse. I guess you could have been partway through the Western or all the way out West and had to hastily return. I suppose on that one side of things, it was good.
Yeah, I mean, even worse for the band, I wasn't set to go with them to Europe. But, you know, if they had gone to Europe, like if they had gotten on that flight, they're supposed to be home for like, you know, 40 hours or maybe even less and then hop on a plane to Europe. If they had gone there and then lockdown happened, I cannot imagine the trouble they would have been in.
Yeah. Well, I guess for people listening who maybe don't know much about sound engineers as a career, tour management as a career, I don't know how far ahead you typically would have booked or like what kinds of financial securities are in place for changes of plans. I guess, like, are there any? Like, how far ahead had you planned at that point?
I mean, under normal circumstances for the artist, from the artist's perspective, there are guarantees built into the contract that are booked, you know, 3 to 6 months ahead in advance. So they know even if something's getting canceled, then they're still going to get, you know, X amount of dollars as a guarantee. But with the COVID situation, it was literally unprecedented. It had not happened before. So no, nobody knew what was going to happen at all, and losses were and are extreme because, you know, everyone I'm sure has worked out a bit of a different deal, and I haven't really been talking to management about how all that wrapped up or what to expect in the future because everyone's just sort of sitting, enjoying their time the best way they can. But yeah, there's, for a situation like this, there's no guarantee for what was booked, as far as I understand it. And I don't think, you know, moving forward, Live Nation had issued a statement about, you know, guarantees are dropping substantially for artists in the future, whenever that future may be. Usually you pay out guarantees in advance. That's also changing. To what degree, I'm not totally sure yet. I'm not sure if anyone is. Yeah, there's, it's just a vast ocean of uncertainty.
Yeah. I guess I didn't even really realize I've played shows like festivals where there's some fine print that says if for whatever reasons, you know, the festival had to be canceled, sometimes it's like 50 or 80% of what they promised would still be paid out. There's different arrangements, but
yeah, minus acts of God and whatnot.
Yeah. Where does a global pandemic, is that included in the fine print of any of these situations?
'Cause I think it will be now. Yeah. I hope so. Yeah. But previous, no.
No, okay. Yeah. It was just such a strange thing because, you know, how like you picture those guarantees to be such that you expect maybe one show in a tour or two shows, you know, like there could be random things that happen to one venue. But yeah, it is kind of a sweep that happens simultaneously everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a sweep of everyone's 6 to 8 months in the future, just instantly being annihilated.
Yeah. Well, okay, but in terms of being the live sound on the gig or the tour manager on the gig, is there any kind of security in that position when it comes to this kind of scale of tour?
I mean, I would consider myself sort of a mid-level crew member. You know, I'm not doing big, giant stadiums often unless they are festivals or I am with a band that is in support of a larger band. But, you know, I have pretty close relationships with the bands that I work with, so I know that they're going to do whatever they can. I also keep it pretty casual. I don't make my clients sign contracts or do anything like that. I know some people do. Maybe it would be smarter if I did, saying, you know, if something like this happens, you know, 30 or 50% of book dates need to be paid. But, I that's just not my way. And the artists that I've been working a lot with the last few years are doing what they can to, you know, be really helpful. So I have no complaints.
Fair enough. But, yeah. I feel for where you're coming from, because even if you did have some sort of contract in place, there's a major difference between a band, you know, suddenly deciding, hey, maybe we can do our own sound or use the sound guys there and bailing on you versus their shows, in fact, are completely gone too, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. There's a big difference between like, forget this guy, we don't want him around anymore, yeah, get him off the tour that we booked him on, and us and every other artist in the world is completely in trouble right now. So I think to take someone to town over an unprecedented situation like that would be kind of uncool.
Yeah. How far ahead had you booked yourself? Like, I know you mentioned that you weren't going to be on that European leg, but probably you still did have plans that ceased.
I was booked technically until sometime in September, and a bunch of tentative dates all the way to the new year. Wow. So tentative dates meaning just waiting on ink on the contract, essentially, between the booker and the promoter. But yeah, like my year was set. I mean, that year was set the year before when we knew a record was coming. So it's like, I, you know, before the pandemic hit, I could have told you what city. Yeah, I could have told you what city I'd be in, what time I was eating dinner, like where I would be on a festival ground. I could have told you down to the minute exactly where I would have been all the way up to Christmas.
Are you, like, still kind of experiencing weird moments where it occurs to you where you would be? I've had the odd one, not too many, but like just the odd moment where I realize I'm sitting in my backyard and I would have been, like for me, I was going to be up in the Yukon, so that was pretty notable. But I mean, most of what I had planned was not too far from home, so I'm curious if, like, when, you know, you start to feel a particular weather front and then you, like, look at the date and you're like, well, hey, I would have...
I still do find myself, if I feel like a waft of cold air, I'll like crack open my iPhone radar app and just to look at the weather system moving to be like, do I got to get these guys off stage or what's going on? And then I realize, no, it doesn't matter. I mean, weather radar, that's cool to look at. But relax, man. I have had a few moments where I'm sitting with my family in the summertime, which is like, you know, usually I get that once, maybe twice a summer if I'm lucky. And it's been happening more to be around the people that I love and just sort of thinking, you know, like I miss my job, but also this is pretty nice to see those special people in this nice time of year. I haven't had a Toronto summer in 5 years, maybe more. Yeah. So like to be in the city, even though it's weird COVID vibes, it's still kind of like, oh yeah, this is how you people live around here. Everyone biking around and wearing shorts. This looks pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, one of the nice things about sort of the family hangs is there's sort of there. Obviously, there's like the familiarity of it being your family, but it isn't a regimented, scheduled style of hangout. You know, there isn't like now it's 6:10, so we get prepared for dinner in like that same kind of way that work really is. And so I kind of find like, yeah, you can get kind of lost in those types of hangouts without making too much pressure around timelines and things too. So it is kind of like a totally different situation.
It's pretty special around 4 o'clock to be like, oh, I guess it's cocktail hour. Maybe we make a family spritzer rather than like, oh, geez, I got to get these guys their meal tickets and get back to the riser and make sure I've done that sub snake before rollout. You know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, this is great. But yeah, working and making money is also great. So it's, you know, double-edged.
Mm-hmm. How much thought have you given to what returning will look like? So when I talked to a venue owner about the future of live music, and obviously with like a whole bunch of question marks, one of the things I was most curious about, especially in the first month or two, was when it comes to honoring dates, when it comes to rescheduling, if things were going to move down the line in kind of like a queue, or if there was going to be like a complete do-over on the other side in terms of like festivals that had booked certain acts, when it came to like album releases that had certain tours in place. Are you getting any sort of sense from the people you work with whether the approach will be more like trying to recreate what they had planned for, or if we've crossed a point where it's going to be just completely fresh start?
I know in March when it all started, I had some clients who quickly rebooked everything that was supposed to be summer starting in September because the vibe then that I don't know if there was any reason that any of us thought this, but it was like by fall, you know, probably be okay. Hopefully be okay. Let's rebook for fall. I haven't had discussions with management about what's happening with those dates. I can't imagine they'll be happening. If they were, I would hope I would have received an email by this point. And I don't know. I guess that's maybe a conversation better had with either management personnel or a booker. But my guess would be that it's got to be clean slate. And then when the doors do open up again, so to speak, it's going to be a little crazy because you're going to have every artist who's been not generating income for however long it will have been at that time, you know, fighting when you're talking about just regular tour, you know, fighting for the same venues because there's only, you know, so many venues at the same capacities in every city. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to festivals, I feel like there'll be a little more flexibility. Everyone will want to do it. That's assuming that anyone wants to pay for a ticket You know, I was thinking about it from your perspective, where it's like, one, like, festivals all across the world that had reached like heavy saturation point, where there was just, they started dropping like flies, because there were so many festivals happening all over the place that it was more than the public could or would support. And I was like, yeah, like thinking about Guelph, I was like, well, they've got Hillside, but imagine Hillside had like, you know, two or three more festivals of the same level or higher, mm-hmm. like it would just crumble. So I don't know, like, so maybe it's going to knock out some of these festivals that were sort of on shaky ground to begin with moving forward. And that could make for a nicer marketplace for the ticket buyer. And everyone would still be able to work because there were so many festivals before. Mm-hmm. But if do people want to pay to go stand around with 25,000 people? I don't know. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Like, one theory that had crossed my mind that seems almost, as I'm watching things like the Maritimes bubble form and concepts like that, like I had a guest in PEI, and PEI, this was months ago, had already been deemed safe because right. it's a very small island. So they could literally say, mm-hmm. you can't come or go and control that. But obviously other parts of Canada are way harder to put some sort of frame around. However, it did strike me that with things like the bubble, perhaps you see a whole new relationship with local music. Like, maybe the notion of touring is farther off because the idea of moving from point A to point B and, you know, attracting large crowds because it's a novelty that you're there. So people come out of the woodwork to see someone who they haven't seen there since like last year or something. Mm. If it's local and therefore slightly less novel and therefore attracts a smaller crowd, but also it's a crowd and a band who are both from the same kind of general area that you have a feel for. And so the one kind of like interesting twist I had come up with in my head was perhaps the livelihood returns. It's just much more focused locally, you know, and not necessarily any fewer gigs for people like yourself, but completely different responsibilities, I suppose, within it.
I suppose. I mean, I see what you're saying. I think it's a really nice idea. Things are getting focused locally, local artists engaging directly with their community, and I think that's really cool. On the flip side of that, for people like me who make their life as a crew member, that would continue to be devastating to the bottom line, I think, because, you know, a big part of why people are paying for me to go with them on the road is you're getting consistency. That's probably the biggest one, consistency day to day. You know, if you're doing a one-off close to your house, you know, there's not really much to TN there. There's no hotels to book. There's no travel itin. It's like, I'll see you guys there at this time. And hey, is Justin around? Maybe he wants to mix, you know?
Yeah.
That would be, you know, I think where I would fit into a scenario like that is then if we're allowed to do local gatherings, maybe there is a local production company in which I could get hired by and be you know, quote unquote, the house guy or something. But I've never really had my eye on those gigs. Not that that's, I could do it, but I liked traveling with the same people.
Yeah, and, no, I totally do understand that. Yeah. I don't know. There's so much, I guess, to consider within it. Do you know if any of the artists that you've been traditionally working with are starting to shift their focus away from music? Like, has this been a long enough time off the road for any of them to start looking seriously at other livelihoods, or are they still mostly in the camp of like have found ways to make it work?
I think they're pretty deep in it at this point where it's not really something they're going to walk away from unless they absolutely have to. I know, you know, for the artist, there's multiple revenue stream, right? You've got, you know, live shows and touring, which is huge. But then you've also got record sales, which is obviously not so great. But, you know, you've also got royalties and media placements and sync licenses and all these other streams. So I don't know that their revenues have ceased, but the biggest revenue has ceased. Mm-hmm. And because that's the part of their business that I was attached to, all of my revenue has ceased. Yeah. But I think, you know, I think as far as I know, everyone is just sort of woodshedding. I think everyone's doing a lot of writing and demoing and trying to use the time as best they can to be as productive as they can in an uncertain future, which I think is probably the right call as an artist. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know a lot of artists who are like, ah, I'm done with it. You know, I'm sure there's some. And if you need a break, yeah, breaks are good. I'm sort of feeling the positive side of it, that being off the road can be healthy and grounding. And I hope they are too. And I'm using that to make really great stuff that someday someone will hear.
Well, yeah, that's, I have to hope that the other side of this is getting to hear a lot of stuff being kind of like workshopped right now, because that's just a really exciting possible silver lining for sure.
Absolutely.
I would love to know your opinion on, you know, obviously there at first was a huge surge in these online performances. It has kind mm-hmm. of petered out somewhat, but I guess some of the infrastructure for it is also maybe getting more formalized. And I don't know if your artists are folks who have utilized this. I don't know your opinion from a tech side of things, of whether you like this as a possible thing going forward or... I guess one reason I wanted to ask was because the tech on it has been so terrible in most yes. cases of what I've watched. And it has struck me that there could potentially be a role for somebody who knows what they're doing from a tech side of things to support the infrastructure of these things. It's a missing piece, in my opinion. But
yeah, I have seen other technician pals who have gotten the odd job of... you know, audio operator for a live stream. And I generally, though, I think those are sort of the bigger live streams where it's like full band on stage, you know, full mics, lights, the whole thing. And they're also, you know, probably on in-ears. So operator is managing the in-ears for the band as well as the mix that goes to Zoom. And it sounds challenging, but it sounds cool. And I think there are definitely people who are doing that, but that's not going to be like, you know, artists are doing like a once a week live stream or something. You're not going to do that once a week because you're, my understanding of it is that you're sort of out there dancing for pennies, so to speak. You're getting donations and it's like, it's not viable to pay someone a decent rate to come in and do that once a week. That said, Andy Schaaf did do a streamed show live, but it was also ticketed, I believe. And his looked really good. That said, he's one of those artists who records all his own stuff, has a good audio brain, and understands the technology. And he just set up a couple really nice mics and had some, you know, nice lighting in the room. And it looked great, sounded great. I was surprised because I hadn't really seen one that I wanted to give a thumbs up, and that one was really, really good. I don't see there being an avenue of revenue for a technical person where that's happening on a you know, 5 days a week, maybe in the corporate world and not the indie rock world.
Right. Yeah, it's another one of those ones that because we've been limping along, like, I think we're kind of interesting in Canada. We keep extending timelines bit by bit instead of, you know, firmly just saying this many months. So, for example, in March, I interviewed somebody in the UK, and he already knew his kids wouldn't be going back to school until at least September. And he knew that in March, right? And I remember talking to him and being like, I wonder if my kids are also not going back till September, but they're going to keep telling me 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks up until the September. And that is essentially what has happened. But it has occurred to me that if we were given a more firm timeline, like say we knew definitively no touring no onstage performances till 2022, would there be an incentive to lean into that platform out of like the fact that everybody would just know that that was the only version?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I could see some artists doing that for sure. I don't think every artist necessarily enjoys that kind of performance.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of them do. I think it's tough. You don't have feedback from your audience. It's just you staring at a screen. You may or may not be in an inspiring place. As we mentioned, may or may not have inspiring audio or visual. So I think there's like a lot of artists who aren't feeling it and for good reason. But every once in a while, you know, it's nice to connect in that way and remember that there are still people out there that are, you know, or feel that what you're doing is important and valued. I don't think the timeline, I don't think everyone would jump on board if there's a timeline, but most certainly some would.
Yeah.
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Justin Nace, a front-of-house audio engineer and tour manager who's recently taken to pasta making.
Yeah, it's definitely, I've been thinking through lots of different scenarios, and it does seem like, I don't know, there's the point at which you are on a break and you're waiting for things to return to something that will resemble what it was, and then there's a point where you enter a completely unprecedented future. Right. And so it's, I can't help but feel like for every person who has not thought about going forward, in order for there to be something going forward, somebody's got to be like spitballing completely new ideas right now. Right. Somebody behind the scenes, venues or whatever, are like 5 years ahead in terms of some weird scheme.
You know, I think there's, from the venue perspective, I think there's a lot of that going on. Definitely. Again, how viable is something like that? I don't know. Like, how many staff are you going to have? Well, you know, like, what's overhead on, like, a really sharp streamed production? I think a lot.
Yeah.
To do it properly, to do, like, a television quality stream, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's a ton of money. So what are you going to do? Charge everybody $75 to watch a stream? I don't know.
No, I mean, I think something like that's going to have to be a complete do-over in terms of what, like, where support comes from, right? There'd have to be, like, an entirely new set of partners in the room that were helping subsidize it, I think, at that point. I don't think that it could fall on, you know, an audience's shoulders anymore. I mean, already, even if it went back to, like, normal venues, but with half capacity, I don't think it could really be on the shoulders of audience members. You know?
No, I mean, not unless you're talking about like 100 cap or less venues. I mean, once you're getting into venues over that size, just the overhead to open the doors is, it's ridiculous. The rent and the, just the standard expenses to have one show are thousands upon thousands of dollars. So to run that at half capacity, I mean, if there are venue owner operators and managers who want to take that on, I love you guys. That's amazing. But like, in my eyes, I'm just like, how are you going to do that?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I one thing I've imagined is you have one legitimate venue show as an artist, maybe like a year, and then the rest are everything's a venue, but there's only five people there. So you're playing people's lawns and living, you know, kind of like just a weird version of the living room concert series, but with like strange, I don't know. Well, anyways, let's shift out of, so at some point, you know, March happened and everything kind of had the brakes put on, and you had everything up into the new year kind of go into like gray area unknown. At what point did you start to shift your focus away from being on a hiatus and into looking ahead to other ways to sort of maybe support yourself or even just other interests to lean into?
I think that's what it was for me. I mean, I've never really taken on a job just for, fiscal means of support. It's always, what can I do that'll make me happy? What's going to be fun? And, you know, I'd mentioned I was in quarantine and then under the weather for, you know, locked away for almost a month by myself. I live alone. It was crazy. It was, you know, it was like coming off the road. It's like, yeah, lying in bed, watching a bunch of Netflix. Yeah, that's not so bad. But 3.5 weeks, it was just like, I am not feeling great at this point. And I had been making pasta at home for the last couple of years, and I don't know if you've ever done it, but it's pretty meditative and still and calm, and you're alone, and my brain feels quiet when I do it. It's kind of a beautiful thing, and there's a big payoff at the end. You get to eat fresh pasta, and it's delicious. So I was doing that and just reading everything that I could, getting, you know, a few new cool toys and items for the kitchen. And my girlfriend was like, this is good. You should see if anyone wants this. And after a while, it was like, yeah, okay, maybe you're right. And so that's sort of what it was. Pasta for love of the game.
Does it stay meditative when you, because I see all those articles that pop up from time to time that are, insist that you should not turn everything into a job, that sort of, and I think like our generation, I'm a tiny bit older than you, I think, but we're kind of like us and slightly younger people than us are kind of like maybe especially guilty of turning everything into a hustle. But does it stay meditative when you have to start thinking like business?
I mean, the first weekend that I was making it for other people, it was pretty crazy. That did not feel particularly meditative. Early mornings, not something I'm used to doing. Making pasta for anyone but me and my immediate family and loved ones, definitely not anything I ever attempted to do. Yeah, it was scary and hard. Second weekend, it felt great again. You know, just waking up early, giving myself lots of time to get it done. It's still, I'm hearing birds outside. The city's still quiet. It was really nice. And there's a strange similarity in trying to figure out the logistics of a side hustle as there are to the logistics of like a TM job, where it's like, okay, what is our new protocol here? How are we going to do this? How is this going to move? Is this the most efficient use of our time and supplies? And there was a lot that felt really comfortable there too. So I'm going to say as it continues in, the easier it gets and the easier I'm able to make more without, freaking it. Still feels pretty good.
I'm really glad to hear that. That is super relatable. Like it, you describing you planning the business side of it reminds me of like silk screening. And similarly, I feel like it does tap into like my tour booking kind of like, looking at all of these lists of contacts, the timelines, the due dates. So there's a lot there.
There's so much that reminds me of, you know, like early on and you put out your first or second record or whatever, and maybe you're like making the artwork yourself and you're folding the cardboard and you're putting ink stamps on everything. And I was just like, oh my God, I've already done this a couple times. This is easy. It's just like putting out a home record. No problem. I can ink stamp some boxes and pack some bags all over it.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious if, you can describe your process for radio. Is there a way to walk me through the creation of some from fresh pasta? You can choose your own style of pasta if you think one makes for a better audio narrative.
Oh boy. Well, Like, you mean like walk through my day, or like just like the crafting of handsome?
I'll leave that up to you. I don't know which makes for a better story.
It beats me. I can't even believe I'm here. Well, you start with a big lump of dough that you, well, let's go back further, actually. Mm-hmm. You start with flour and eggs, hopefully the best flour you can find. If you're going to really go for it, it's going to be what they call double zero flour, which is a very finely ground Italian wheat. And that's so when you roll it out, it's going to roll out really, really smooth. It's much finer than an all-purpose flour. Mm. And then you're going to find the absolute best eggs that you can find if you're going to make a traditional egg dough. And that means like yolks that are not yellow, but not yellow like the sun, but like orangey, or some, if you get really lucky, maybe even kind of red. Oh. That's if you can get those kind of eggs, oh, you're living. Oh my God, it's beautiful. And you can either, I make my dough in a stand mixer. If you were to just do it at home, you know, you'd make a little mountain of flour on your countertop, make a little well in the top of it, a little hole, divot, put your moisture in there, whether it be eggs or just water, if you're making a more traditional southern dough. Incorporate your flour with your finger or a fork until it all starts to hydrate and work together. Knead it so it's smooth and supple and beautiful, and when you push your finger into it, it bounces back with a little gluteny sproinginess. Let it rest. So then it becomes soft again, because it's going to be all tight from all the protein and the flour and the eggs that have been worked up with the moisture and the kneading. You let it rest until it becomes soft, and then you sheet it. You can sheet it with traditionally like mezzarello, which is like a very, very long, it doesn't have to be very long, but typically they're like, you know, a yard long or longer, rolling pin. Or you can use a pasta machine that is two rollers that slowly come together, and you start very fat and you work it very, very thin, anywhere from a couple of millimeters to less than a millimeter thin, depending on the shape you're going to make. And then from there, you would either roll it up and cut it into long strips for noodles, or if you're doing stuffed pasta, you would lay down whatever you're stuffing it with and flip it over on itself and seal it and cut it. And if you're doing hand shapes, you're not making sheets. You are probably rolling out little snakes and cutting off little nubbins and rolling them on a textured device or using a kitchen knife or whatever to get your various hand rolled shapes. How'd I do?
I think that's amazing. I already have some questions. Do you use a hand crank pasta maker yourself, or do you have like an electric version that flattens?
Yeah, I went big on the pasta roller just because I knew I was going to be making it not just for me and my girlfriend or me and my mom or something. Mm-hmm. So I have one that has a motor. You can buy motors for some of those hand crank ones. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of... can't remember the company names off the top of my head, but the most common ones do have motors that you can buy. They probably cost as much as the machine you just bought. Or there's a few other bigger ones that also have motors. It is very handy to have two hands when dealing with, you know, 10-foot long sheets of very thin dough. Yeah, so that was nice.
Do you operate it with like a foot pedal, like kind of like a sewing machine, so you can be faster or slower, or is it just going?
No. It's an always on, operates at one speed, and you were just controlling the width between the two rollers.
Yeah, okay.
That's the only variable control.
It seems, I've only made pasta once, and I had the hand crank style, but even I had my daughter helping, so one of us could crank and one of us could feed. But even doing that, it kind of got away from me. Like, there were moments where there's just seemed like way too much was going through and then not enough. And I was getting all of these wonky, you know, I wasn't getting one nice strip. And so the motorized actually strikes me as kind of like mildly terrifying to imagine trying to.
I think a lot of it is getting your shape of your dough nice before you even start one pass through the machine.
Okay.
So if you're just using a pin to flatten it, you know, the real the real heavy past the people. They make this perfect, beautiful, perfect circle with this rolling pin and make all the shapes from that. If you're using a machine, it doesn't really make so much sense to make a circle because you're making long rectangular sheets. Yeah. But if you can make a real nice sort of slab of rectangular dough that is just a little thinner than the widest setting on your roller, it's going to roll out in a nice flat sheet. And then you've got your backhand, you've got the dough draped over it, creating a tension before the rollers. Oh. And you can sort of create a degree of control there. And then your front hand is just sort of carrying the beautiful sheets out of the way and making sure they don't stick.
Okay. What was the biggest learning curve?
Oh, everything. I've never worked in food. I've never worked in hospitality. I've never done any of that stuff. I don't even know where to begin. It was just reading and interneting constantly every day for like a year.
Well, then how did you get into it in the first place if it was all so challenging? What was the draw?
I like cooking. I like mm-hmm. making dinners, especially when it's, you know, when I'd been on the road, cooking for myself felt pretty novel. Making my own meal was like, yeah, this is wild. People do this every day. Oh my God. So it felt really special. And to make a special thing, a fresh homemade pasta to me, that's a special thing. That feels special. So it was like, yeah, we're going to do a nice dinner. I'm home. This is going to be the thing. And I think that was what made me work through making a lot of batches of not so pretty pasta. But even ugly pasta still tastes amazing, usually.
Well, I was going to ask, like, where does it go wrong? Like, when somebody is not, is skipping steps, or are there certain things that are the most likely places to be, like, the big fail?
Hydrate your dough, so give it enough time to fully hydrate. Resting your dough so it gets soft enough to roll and has a nice texture. And on the other side of it, you know, when you're shaping your shapes, the first couple times you do it, it's always going to be hideous. It's just going to be hideous. It's going to look ugly, but it'll taste good. So don't stress. Eat the ugly pasta, try it again, and it'll definitely get better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What is the most satisfying at point where, like, it's in one form a moment ago, and then now it looks like this? What's your favorite moment of the pasta make?
I think for me, making it, scaling it up and trying to make larger batches, you roll your dough, you sheet your dough, you cut your shape, and then you've already cured the shapes before you've cut them. And then I've been curing them again after I cut them. Mm-hmm. And then I get to take them off this big, long, dry rack of wooden dowel and scoop them up in my hand or on a stick and apply coarse ground semolina just to make sure they don't stick in packaging. And just like holding it and seeing them all very uniform and together, and like they all look the same after having spent time, you know, where it's not all looking the same. To have it consistent and beautiful is very rewarding.
That sounds extremely satisfying.
It is, yeah.
There's very few things I do that they all look nice and uniform in the end, but so yeah.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. Oh man, that's awesome. So if you got the phone call that, you know, we found some sort of, either cure or preventative measure that is working and we can go back to something like normal, and you got to go back to music, if it like would it at this point, is it still like a for sure you'd go back to business as before, or are you starting to feel like a shift in terms of where to place your energies?
I mean, I would say it's too early in the pasta game to feel like what I'm talking about, like 15 years of audio,
yeah,
and touring at this point, which even that feels crazy to say. But yeah, like it's pretty, I'm like a month in to the pasta game right now.
Yeah.
So yeah, if someone wanted to go hit some shows and it could be done safely for me and the client, as well as the ticket buyer and the venue staff. Yeah, I would do that. And also, I don't imagine this thing's going to, when the gates open up, I don't picture it being like the horses at a racetrack. You know, it's not going to be like, boom, and everyone starts running. I think it's going to be a slow trickle. And I think that's going to be good for me and my brain, too, to slowly figure it out, just like everyone else will be.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I suppose it's extremely unlikely a scenario in which you'd have to make a hard line between one and the other.
You know? Yeah, I don't think, like, you know, the government's going to be like, okay, we can do shows now, and every band I've ever worked for is going to be like, I got 6 months of dates lined up. Let's get on the bus. I'll be like, what? I don't see that. I don't see it going that way.
Well, okay, that being said, has your love of pasta and, you know, the possibility of shifting towards that as a livelihood, have things shifted in terms of, like, putting any of the kind of urgency or worry at bay? Like, are you starting to feel that feeling of, like, because, I mean, even if it wasn't pasta, there's something to be said for discovering something that shows that alternatives are possible, right? That like, yeah, your livelihood could look a different way. And have you felt that it's starting to kind of lift the pressure in that way?
I think a lot of that is always perspective, you know, mm-hmm. like pre-pandemic, you know, I definitely caught myself saying more than once, well, what the heck else would I do? You know, like, I've been doing this for so long. It's all I know. I don't have an education beyond technical school for fantasy studies, which is what my friend JJ calls my recording college education. So, you know, like, I did feel, oh, you know, what are my other options besides this touring life that I've made for myself as I approach 40? And before a pandemic, I felt very little. This pasta thing, it's feeling really good. I'm really happy doing it. Whether or not it's got 15-year-long legs, I don't know. But like I said, perspective, it does make me think, oh yeah, you're not trapped. You're never trapped. Yeah. You can make choices and it will be all right.
Well, one thing that's very beautiful about you describing your relationship with it is it seems like, I think some people, there's kind of like maybe an internal anxiety or an instinct that you had to become all the things you would need in your home, because we don't know if we'll have access to things. When I really thought the idea of us leaning into something that feels right and really counting on community more than ever while we're in isolation, like, you fit into that image of, you know, somebody's the pasta maker, somebody is the person, you know, like, we don't need to be all of the, right out of, like, the oldest rhyme, you know, and I kind of, I find that really beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way. I do think it's really special to feed friends and family and people in my community and get, you know, like, getting messages back where I'm seeing people's kids with just like red sauce smeared all over their face. That feels really special. That's beautiful. And I'm really excited that I can be the guy giving that sauce to that kid to smear all over their own head right now.
Yeah. That's a really good segue to, I have two questions that I typically ask most people, and one is around support. So, it seemed like a segue. It maybe is a confusing segue, but I'm curious, like, what are some things you've seen support look like during this time that have been really, like, helpful? And or if you've had an idea of what support could look like that is kind of missing or could come to the table. So, like, you can answer it kind of from whatever lens you want, if it would be personal or for people you know or for, like, you know, the musician livelihood, but if there's something that strikes you as a good form for support to take during an unprecedented global pandemic.
I mean, I hesitate to comment on federal and provincial, you know, funding topics, because that's not my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I do know a lot of people who have been getting the funding, and it's really made this okay, where I don't think it would have been okay without it. I think it would have been really, really, really bad. So that's amazing. As a crew member, I received a small amount of funding from Live Nation, which is very helpful. But I think in terms of support for our community, I think it's about, you know, we got to social distance, we got to wear masks. But I think it's super cool to just ask people, how are you doing? Do you need anything? The old lady up the street, or, you know, the guy who lives in your building, or whatever. Just like, hey, do you need a hand with anything? Because chances are, maybe you have time right now. Maybe if you're a parent and you have two kids at a school or something, you don't have a lot of time right now. But there are those of us who do. And, you know, if there's someone who was having a hard time getting out of the house for whatever reason to do with this pandemic and wanted some pasta, it's like, hey, reach out. I'll give you some pasta. I can do that. That's very easy, and it would bring me pleasure. And I think all of us might have something like that. So just help your neighbor. Help your neighbor. That's all. Do it.
Yeah, that was my segue. I was trying to remember where it was tethered to, but it was when you were describing feeding the people in your life. That was just like a very beautiful, very literal form of support that you're able to provide. And that's kind of amazing.
It feels pretty amazing. And the pictures are adorable.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, my other question is one around silver linings. And so definitely not suggesting that a global pandemic is not an extremely serious and intense situation. People have been going through really difficult times, obviously. But that being said, we are seeing glimpses of new things, or some things have shifted. And sometimes I think that there are ones that we would even want to keep going. Like, even if we got to return, maybe we get to return with like some of that perspective you mentioned, that like we know now we've had some time away, or we've had time to look at things differently, that we'd love to advocate for something to be retained. Is there something that has struck you as like a silver lining, a moment that you've watched or experienced that you would love to see continued?
I mean, I know early on, I remember seeing a lot of social media posts from friends and such being like, you know, it's really not that hard for me to work from home. Oh, I can actually work from home. And for a lot of those people, I hope in some way, in some capacity, even if it's a limited capacity, I hope they can continue to do that. Cars off the road, close to home, close to family. It all sounds really good. I mean, I don't know what it's like for, you know, the employer of a data management company. Are they still seeing their numbers getting crunched as fast and as efficiently as they would like to have seen with all these people working from home? I have no idea. But I hope so. And I hope that more people are able to do that if and when this situation changes and opens up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good one. I've enjoyed that as well. There's been a lot of, you know, the crowds have been replaced by quality hangouts, you know, even the ones at a distance. And I'm really feeling that after several months of that form of hanging out, it's hard to miss a crowd right now.
Tell me about it. Yeah, I don't need a pass to go anywhere and no one's in my way spilling a drink on me. Yeah.
No drunk hugs.
No, from strangers that I don't want to hug. Yeah.
All right. Well, if people are listening and are curious about your past adventure and want to see where this takes you, what is the best way to keep in touch with you and or kind of follow along as you shift towards pasta maybe being more available to more folks? What's the best way to find you?
I would say check it out on Instagram at Menalon Fresca. It is M-E-N-A-L-O-N Fresca, F-R-E-S-C-A.
Awesome. Okay, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Just stay safe, eat some pasta, and feel full.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to connect today. I really had a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me, Jenny.
So once again, that was Justin Nace, a front-of-house audio engineer, a tour manager, and recently a pasta maker. And you can check out his pasta at Menalon Fresca on Instagram. That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform for us sharing what we are doing to get through this time together in the wake of COVID-19. To take us to the end of the hour, I'm going to play a track of music. This song is called Neon Skyline. It's by Andy Schaaf off of his newest album, Neon Skyline.
I called up Charlie about 9:15 and said, what's going on tonight? He said no plans, but I wouldn't mind holding a lighter head tonight. I said, come to the skyline, I'll be washing my sins away. Oh, he just laughed, said I'll be late, you know. So I buttered some bread, chewed my way out the door and walked down the street to the neon skyline. I grabbed myself a stool at the bar. Oh, somehow Rose always knows just exactly what I need. Opened a cold can and set it down in front of me. I said thanks and thought about how Judy used to come here with me. But I got so tired of her calling this our disease. Cause I'm just fine. Sometimes I need to clear my mind. You know how that can be. And I said, greetings, old man. He hung his coat on the wall and took the stool next to mine. He asked Rose for one glass of Merlot.